thing about Close in the Forest is more people show up here on a Sunday morning. Well, they closed them down in Santa Fe. Yeah, they found over 80 abandoned campsites over the Memorial Day weekend. What's with that?
Yeah,
it's crazy. So we just take just a moment and pray for them. Please. Our opening words this morning come to us from Dwayne Fickenstein. Great mystery incarnate in every person and dwelling among us in the midst of our relationships, we need your help. In a world torn by violence and fear, do not let our hearts be hardened. Let us embrace those who are in need of our support. Help us to move beyond seeking justice to seeking a world governed by grace. Help us to know what needs to be done and how to do it. Where we find suffering, may we bring compassion. Where we find fear, may we bring courage. And where we find hate, may we bring love. So I invite you now into a time of meditation and reflection. And as you're comfortable doing so, perhaps close your eyes, relax into your chair, take a couple of deep breaths, let them out. And find that still place within. And I'm thinking this morning about all the lives that are affected by things like fires. The firefighters, people's homes, people's lives, the lives of the animals and the trees, the creepy crawlies and the winged ones and the four-leggeds. And we're all connected together. Parker J. Palmer writes these words: solitude does not necessarily mean living apart from others. Rather, it means never living apart from one's self. It is not about the absence of other people. It is about being fully present to ourselves, whether or not we are with others. Community does not necessarily mean living face to face with others. Rather, it means never losing the awareness that we are connected to each other. It is not about the presence of other people. It is about being fully open to the reality of relationship, whether or not we are alone.
This first one is Song of Bernadette, which he co-wrote with Jennifer Warnes.
So I was going to talk about community today, and I suppose I still am, but from a different perspective. Because the single event changed some things for me around this talk today. I was in El Paso, Texas on Friday the 18th when the news broke about a shooting at Santa Fe High School. And my first thought was for my hometown and my friends. With kids in high school, with teenagers. But it turned out there's a Santa Fe, Texas.
Wow.
It turned out there was in Santa Fe, Texas, and that the killer had stalked the halls of another school. And for a moment, I felt a strange sense of relief. That odd sensation that we get when we have a close call, a near miss. We feel the slight breeze on the back of the neck as death passes us by. And part of me wondered if I would have paid that much attention if the names of the schools had not been the same. But somehow that broke through and made it personal. And these shootings had become so commonplace, so regular, that we're becoming numb to them. Just another shooting at another school with the same dreadful pattern, dreadful, predictable pattern of reporting and responses. And nothing seems to change. If anything, the problem is getting worse. We now average over one school shooting per week in America. And all the high schools in America have become one high school, dreading the day when another young man brings guns to school and starts murdering his teachers and his classmates. And the last life they usually take is their own, although sometimes they do allow themselves to be captured. And you'd think being able to question these few living perpetrators would provide some insight, but it doesn't seem to, really. They're all young, male, disconnected, and pissed off. And the stories are always the same, although the details are different. And the answers have become equally predictable. And I'm not going to rehash those this morning. An article published in the New Yorker a week later had this to say about Santa Fe, Texas. The town has retained a rural, deeply conservative character, bridging Texan culture with the Old South. This week I saw several Confederate flags waving on front lawns. In the 2016 election, nearly 80% of the voters in the Santa Fe precinct supported Donald Trump. And several people told me that, on the local list of priorities, guns are not far behind God. And the students stand by what they've heard from older generations, from their parents, their pastors, their bosses, their elected officials, all their lives. They seem reluctant to join the March for Our Lives movement, which was formed by students in Parkland, Florida in February, after a mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School killed 17 people, most of them teenagers. And yet many of them do want to understand why. Why someone they knew and saw every day could be driven to do something so awful. They may not say guns are the problem, but they are left with the haunting sense that something is wrong. Dylan, a Santa Fe High School student, said, "All I want is for safety to be the feeling we have when we hear the name America, not what we hear now." Would it be unkind of me to point out the karmic irony of that statement? All I want is for safety to be the feeling we have when we hear the name America. When for so many that name evokes just the opposite, both here and abroad. I think it would be. Dylan only knows what he's been taught. And he trusted his patients, his parents and teachers, and his pastors and his leaders, because those are the people he is supposed to trust. His country, his town, his school is supposed to be a safe place, and it isn't. Something's wrong. And that knowledge simmers down deep, and it's not yet fully articulated. And it's not that his teachers and parents and leaders have deliberately misled him. Everything looks fine on the surface, same as it ever was. They still play football on Friday nights, go to church on Sunday morning. As a country, we disagree on the causes of gun violence and on the solutions. It's what's called a wicked problem. A social or cultural problem that is difficult or impossible to solve for many reasons. Our incomplete or contradictory knowledge. The sheer number of people and opinions involved. The large economic burden of a solution, and the interconnected nature of these problems with other problems. These things are all usually present. And it's not the only wicked problem that we face. Racism, inequality, gender bias, violence against women, poverty, climate change. The list is pretty damn long. And the thing about wicked problems is that they can't be fixed. They can't be solved. They can only be mitigated. And this mitigation is not easy or quick or a solitary exercise. Due to the systemic nature of these large problems, knowledge of science, economics, statistics, technology, medicine, politics, and much more are necessary for effective change. And they demand interdisciplinary and intercultural cooperation and collaboration. And most importantly, perseverance. And without collaboration and cooperation, such problems can't even begin to be mitigated. And such large scale cooperation has become impossible. Why? I'm going to ask you to think with me for a moment about time and history and older ways of looking at things. The day and the year and the seasons pass through cycles. Human beings also pass through similar seasons and transitions and passages as they fulfill their destiny. My teachers taught me that we enter this world through the spirit gates of the east, the spring, grow into childhood in the south, which corresponds to the summer, through adolescence in the west, in the autumn, are initiated into adulthood and community in the winter, and then pass into elderhood before returning again to spirit. And in one variation or another, in culture after culture, generations upon generations have followed each other along this ancient cycle. Empires also follow a predictable pattern as they fulfill their destiny, collapsing after about 10 generations or so, roughly 250 years, give or take. The final stages of an empire are marked by very distinct signs and symptoms, as described by Sir John Glubb in his book, The Fate of Empires. And this is true in all 16 empires that he studied, from Asia to the Middle East to the Americas. And what happens is this. Service ethics disappear and selfishness takes over. Education shifts from learning to obtaining qualifications for high-paying jobs. The young and the ambitious seek wealth, not honor or service. Civil conflict increases even as the empire is under threat. Instead of banding together to preserve the nation, internal political factions seek to destroy one another. And at the very end, moral decay sets in. Petty and negative behaviors dominate, including narcissism, consumerism, materialism, and fanaticism. A celebrity culture worships athletes, actors, and musicians. Sound familiar? The masses are distracted by entertainment and sporting events, and the leaders believe they are impervious and will govern forever. And most surprisingly, it's at the very end of an empire that the welfare state and the expansion of universal rights emerges. You'd think it would be earlier, but it's not. Universal citizenship, assistance for the poor, education grants, and free medical care were all offered by the Roman Empire and the Arab Empire of Baghdad, to name a couple. But when the money runs out and the resources fall away, these things disappear. And I believe that the fact of the matter is that we are living in a time when this American empire and perhaps this global civilization is falling apart. This isn't sour grapes or generational dismay. This is what history teaches us. And it's not about being doomed to repeat history. It's understanding that this is what civilizations and human empires do. They collapse every time. We know of some 30 civilizations that have done so. This planet is littered with their ruins. You can't walk anywhere without walking over old homes and stones and bones and relics. And don't make this mistake of thinking, it's different this time. Or, it can't happen here. And we can't make the mistake of thinking that technology will save us. If anything, our technology is accelerating the collapse. Everything rises and everything falls away, so did Zen teachers. And their advice is always the same. Don't get attached. Go with the flow, whether it's rising or falling. Which is harder than it seems. I wish I could tell Dylan that we could prevent this collapse, this unraveling. But there is no way to avoid it. We can only live through it, preserving what we value. I kept thinking about a number of stories, some of them quite old, and they all have to do with shadows and devil's bargains. Because as anyone from earlier times could tell you, the problem with making deals with the devil is not only does the devil usually get the better of you, you lose your soul as well. And one story that kept coming to mind is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin. Some of you may remember this story. Omelas is a shining city of happiness and delight. Omelas is a serene and lovely community whose citizens are intelligent, sophisticated, and cultured. Omelas has no kings or soldiers or priests or slaves. There is no poverty or strife. But the city's constant state of serenity and splendor requires that a single unfortunate child be kept in perpetual filth, darkness, and misery. Once citizens are old enough to know the truth, most, though initially shocked and disgusted, ultimately acquiesce with that one injustice which secures the happiness of the rest of the city. In the words of the story, they would like to do something for the child, but there is nothing they can do. If the child were brought up into the sunlight out of that vile place, if it were cleaned and fed and comforted, that would be a good thing. But if it were done, in that day and hour, all the prosperity and beauty and delight of Omelas would wither and be destroyed. Those are the terms. The story never asks or answers the question of how this devil's bargain was made or who made it. And it doesn't really matter. It's gone on so long, become so entrenched, so part of the fabric of their reality, that the citizens of Omelas cannot imagine a different world. Except for a few. A few citizens, young and old, silently walk away from the city, and no one knows where they go. The story ends with these words. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the city of happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible it does not exist. But they seem to know where they are going. The ones who walk away from Omelas. Sorry. In his book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, Joseph Tanger tells us that a society has collapsed when it displays a rapid and significant loss of an established level of social and political complexity. A fundamental failure of its social and political spheres. And we only need to look to the center, to Washington, D.C., to see the evidence of this. A society has collapsed when it reaches a point where it can no longer maintain the complexity required to keep itself going. Things fall apart pretty quickly then. Usually within decades. We look at our roads, our bridges, our schools, and our institutions. These things can't be fixed. The wheel can't be turned back to a golden age. As the social order fails, people fall back on their own resources. Communities contract. We retreat into clans and tribes and ethnicities. And we can see this happening in real time all around us. And then cynicism sets in. And then despair. Sir John Glove observed that while despair might permeate the greater part of the nation, others achieved a new realization of the fact that only readiness for self-sacrifice could enable a community to survive. Some of the greatest saints in history lived in times of national decadence, raising the banner of duty and service against the flood of depravity and despair. These are the ones who choose to walk away. The ones who finally say that there are some prices that are too high to pay. Who say that community comes before the individual, that discipline and simplicity and self-sacrifice are our guides. Who say that there are some things worth preserving no matter the cost. Who imagine a different future. It's time to start walking away. It's time to start walking towards something else, even if we don't know what that is yet. Because we couldn't save this empire, even if we wanted to. Its time has passed. Even if the hollow shell staggers on for another few decades. And oh yes, things will look normal for a while. But it will be an illusion. But what we can do is work to save our local communities and our organizations, our schools, our towns, and our businesses. In the words of Margaret Wheatley, we can create islands of sanity, amid the dislocation and chaos that accompanies the fall of an empire. So, what is an island of sanity? What does that look like? Margaret Wheatley describes these as places where humans support each other to be generous, creative, and kind. Where broken relationships are rebuilt. Where human beings trust each other to show up in community despite their differences. And yes, that's bloody hard to do right now. Trust has been broken in so many ways, it's hard to know where to begin. But we know where we have to begin. Right here, right now. With ourselves and those closest to us. Trust first. Foster small-scale cooperation and collaboration, be sane, and have faith. Now, I am not suggesting that we completely abandon action in the larger social and political arenas, but we can't ignore or discount the historical context within which that action is taking place. Knowing what is happening and why helps us make sense of who we are and what we do. Our job is not to fix a collapsing empire. Amen. Thank you. Our job is to be kind and generous and creative.
Amen. Yep.
Our job is to be kind and generous and creative. To encourage people not to despair and to also be kind and generous and creative. To remind them that we have been here before as humans. Our ancestors lived through these collapses. And our children and their children will live through this one. And it will be hard. But human beings have lived through much, much worse. We can do it too. There's another world waiting out there. Walk away from this one. That's what I would tell them. Don't.
Amen.
Amen.
So I like to think of my...
I think so.
Over there? I like to think of myself as a baby elder in training. Still got a ways to go, though. Because one of my teachers, Stephen Foster, said that what the society desperately needs more than anything is elders. It doesn't really matter how old you are. But the elders are the people who carry wisdom. And so this is a quote from a man named Martin Shaw, who's a Vision Quest guide in Wales, and a writer, and a mythic storyteller. It's from a book of his called A Branch from the Lightning Tree. And he says, "The job of an elder is to be nuttier, more curiouser, occasionally fierce, and more connected to the eccentricities of wildness than the youth ever dreamed." More than anything, the elder has seen some rough pattern to their life and knows how to express it through a story. This carries tremendous hope with it. Thank you.